the tray of drinks. She set the glasses down on the table in front of the men and gracefully departed. The spotlight dimmed, but there was no doubt that everyone in the club knew that Nick Tremaine and his friend had arrived. "Now what?" Irene said.
"Now we wait," Oliver said.
He fell silent. Irene looked at him. "We should probably look as if we're having a normal conversation."
"What do you want to talk about?"
"There's always the weather."
"Sure," Oliver said.
He did not take his eyes off Tremaine and Enright.
"Or we could talk about what you're going to do when the situation is finished."
"We could," she agreed. She felt as if she were walking across a frozen lake. One misstep and she would fall into the icy depths. He waited a moment. When she didn't say anything else, he took his eyes off Tremaine and Enright long enough to shoot her a wary look.
"Well?" he said.
She moved a hand in a small gesture that she hoped appeared casual, as if the answer to the question was of only mild interest. "I suppose it all depends on what happens here in Burning Cove," she said. "If we can prove that Tremaine killed Gloria Maitland and maybe implicate him in Peggy's death, and if Enright gets arrested for Helen's murder, I will have a brilliant career in journalism ahead of me. But if we can't prove anything, I'll have to change my name again, come up with a new identity, and find another job."
"My hotel can always use the services of a skilled secretary," Oliver said, his tone utterly neutral.
"You've got Elena."
"Yes, and I'm not about to replace her. She's terrific. But there are other departments that could use a person who is skilled in organizing files and typing. Also, we frequently get calls from guests who want to employ a secretary for one reason or another while they're staying at the hotel."
"But I would be working for you," Irene said.
"Got a problem with that?"
"Yes, I do, as a matter of fact."
"Why?"
"Do I have to spell it out for you? I learned the hard way that it's not a good idea to sleep with a boss. And I'm sure you learned that it's not a good idea to have an affair with one of your employees. Or have you forgotten that postcard from Hawaii?"
Oliver winced.
"Right."
She reached across the small table and patted his arm. "Thanks anyway. I appreciate the offer, but don't worry about me. I've been taking care of myself for a long time. I'll be fine." Something grim and edgy sparked in his eyes.
"Let's think about that statement for a moment," he said. "A few months ago, you were forced to drive all the way across the country and change your name because your previous boss was a professional hotel thief who managed to steal a secret notebook that got her killed. And now, the man whom we think murdered her is sitting down there on the dance floor in the same booth as the leading man you suspect of killing your colleague. You call that taking care of yourself?"
Annoyed, she was about to respond when she saw Nick Tremaine extricate himself from the booth. "Tremaine is leaving," she whispered.
Oliver turned to follow her gaze. "I don't think so."
They watched Nick cross to a nearby booth where two young, attractive women sat. He evidently invited one of them to dance. She slipped out from behind the table and eagerly followed him onto the dance floor. It was clear, even from a distance, that she was starstruck. "She'll be dining out on this story for months," Irene said. Julian Enright rose and walked purposely up the aisle. He paused midway to speak to a waiter. A few seconds later, Enright changed direction.
"He's coming our way," Oliver said. "This will be interesting."
"I can't believe this," Irene said.
"I can. The arrogant son of a bitch can't resist."
Julian came to a halt in front of the table. Irene's pulse jumped and her breath got tight. If she and Oliver were right, she was face to face with Helen Spencer's killer. For his part, Oliver seemed to go preternaturally still.
"Sorry to interrupt," Julian said in an easy manner that implied he didn't give a damn. He smiled at Irene. "Allow me to introduce myself. Julian Enright. You must be Irene Glasson, the reporter for Whispers. My friend Nick told me all about you, Evidently, you managed to annoy his studio.
Evidently, his studio was very annoyed, she said, because I am now a former reporter.
Miss Glasson is with me tonight, Oliver said. Irene could have sworn that the temperature in the room dropped to a glacial chill.
Is that so?
Enright did not take his eyes off Irene.
It occurs to me, Miss Glasson, that you could improve your relationship with Tremaine's studio by dancing with me. After all, he and I are friends. If we dance together, it will make people think that you are no longer hounding Tremaine.
Irene sensed that Oliver was about to intervene. She used the toe of her shoe to send a subtle under-the-table message to keep him quiet, and simultaneously gave Julian a cool smile.
"Did Mr. Tremaine send you over here for that purpose, Mr. Enright?" Irene asked.
"I insist you call me Julian, and I must admit it was my own idea."
"Why?" Irene said.
"Because I'm curious about the woman who has the guts to take on a powerful movie studio."
"As it happens, I lost the fight, Mr. Enright. You can tell Nick Tremaine that he has nothing more to fear from me."
"I'll do that. I'm sure he'll be relieved to hear the news, but it doesn't mean we can't dance."
"You heard Mr. Ward. I'm here with him tonight."
"In that case, it looks like you won't be having much fun, will you? A cripple doesn't make a very good dance partner. Oh, well. Irene, perhaps we'll have another opportunity to get to know each other later."
Julian glided away into the shadows. Irene remembered to breathe.
"I can't believe the gall of that man," she said.
"I can. We're right about him. He's here because of you and the notebook."
"You're sure of that?"
"I am now."
Irene watched Julian return to the booth he had shared with Nick Tremaine.
"You seem very sure of your read on Julian Enright," she said. "But what about Tremaine? You haven't said too much about him."
"At the moment, Enright is the more dangerous of the two. Tremaine isn't as smart, but he's far more cautious. He may be a killer, but if that's the case, he's got a clear motive to protect his career. It's probably the only thing he cares about. He won't take chances unless he thinks he has no alternative. Right now, he's hoping the studio has things under control."
"You know, when I came to Burning Cove, I never expected to spend an evening in a fancy nightclub watching a couple of killers drink and dance."
Oliver tasted his martini and lowered the glass. He watched Tremaine and Enright with an unreadable expression.
"Enright was correct about one thing," he said after a moment.
"What?"
"I'm no good on the dance floor."
She smiled. "Lucky for you, you've got other talents," she said.
Chapter 50. She awoke to find herself alone in the bed. The sheets were still warm from Oliver's body heat. She waited a moment to see if he would return, but the clink of crystal on glass in the living room told her that he expected to be gone for a while. She pushed aside the covers, stood, and pulled on her robe. She made her way down the darkened hall and stopped at the entrance of the moon-shadowed living room. At first, she did not see him.
"I didn't mean to wake you," he said.
He spoke from the depths of the big, leather-upholstered reading chair. He was wearing a dark robe. His feet were bare. The moonlight slanted across his injured leg, propped on the hassock. She moved across the room and sat down in the other reading chair.
"How bad is it?"
she asked.
"No worse than usual," Oliver said.
He swallowed some of the whiskey in his glass. It was clear that her question had irritated him. She started to apologize for inquiring about the level of his discomfort, but stopped herself in the nick of time.
"It wasn't the leg that woke me," he said after a while. "It was Enright."
"Do you think we were wrong about him?"
"No. What I'm thinking is that we need to move fast if we're going to trap him. We need to come up with a way to force his hand. Can't risk letting him take the initiative.
What if there's nothing to our suspicions? Irene said. What if he really is just a rich, star-struck tourist who managed to charm a famous star?
If that's the case, he won't take the bait.
What bait?
The notebook. He won't want to take the chance of losing it again. We'll need to set the stage, get the props and the lighting in place. I'll talk to Chester and Luther in the morning.
And me, Irene said. You'll talk to me, too. This is my problem and my story.
Don't worry. You will be a critical part of the act.
You've got a plan?
I think so, yes.
Tell me.
He did. When he was finished, she took a deep breath and released it slowly.
That is very daring, she said, and risky.
Like any good illusion, it is actually very simple technically.
It relies on your read of Enright. If you're wrong...
No.
Oliver drank some more whiskey and lowered the glass.
Tonight, he confirmed everything I sensed about him. He's cold-blooded, arrogant, and impulsive.
Irene shivered. I wonder how many people he has murdered.
We'll probably never know, Oliver said, but I very much doubt that Helen Spencer was the first.
He swallowed a sip of his whiskey, set the glass aside, and absently started to massage his left leg. Irene watched him for a moment, and then she got up, knelt beside his chair, and put her hands on his thigh. She could feel the pain tautened muscles and sinews beneath the fabric of his robe.
Let me do this, she said.
Forget it.
She ignored him and started to massage his leg, applying gentle but firm pressure. To her surprise, he stopped arguing. After a while, he even seemed to relax.
Have you ever told anyone what went wrong in your final performance? She asked.
Accidents sometimes happen when you mess around with dangerous things like guns.
I don't think it was an accident. He went very still.
What makes you so sure? He finally asked.
The fact that you won't talk about it.
No one likes to talk about a failure, certainly not a career-killing mistake.
You've got a right to your secrets, she said.
You had a right to your secrets, too. But now I know some of them.
Yes, you do.
My secrets are dead and buried, Oliver said. But sometimes I find myself dealing with a ghost.
She didn't ask any more questions, just continued to knead his leg. After a time, he started to talk.
It was the Cage of Death illusion, he said. Geddings created the original version, but Uncle Chester and I made a few changes to enhance the audience appeal.
Who is Geddings?
He was a friend, and one of the most skilled magicians I have ever known. He taught me a great deal. He went by the title of the Great Geddings.
Never heard of him.
That was his problem. He was incredibly talented when it came to the technical aspects of an illusion, but he wasn't much of a performer. Success on the stage is all about telling a story. The ability to draw the audience into the magic, make people willing participants in the illusion, is what separates the stars from the merely competent. For all his skill, Geddings couldn't read a crowd. He couldn't establish the rapport that's needed on stage, but he taught me a great deal, and we made a good team.
What happened?
We started out as partners, billed the act as Geddings and Ward. But it soon became clear that, although I wasn't better than Geddings in the technical sense, I was the one who could attract and hold an audience's attention. We changed the name of the show to the Amazing Oliver Ward Show.
Which became famous.
We did quite well. Then the disaster occurred.
That would have been about 2 years ago.
Right.
Oliver was silent for a moment. We were in San Francisco. We had a full house. After being suitably locked up in the usual flashy chains and manacles,
I was lowered into a steel cage. The cage was hoisted several feet off the floor.
To show the audience that you couldn't get out through a trap door at the bottom.
You learn fast.
Oliver drank a little more whiskey.
A curtain was lowered. The lights were focused on the draped cage. All standard effect stuff, but the audience loved it. At that point, a mysterious figure wearing a cape and a mask appeared. He circled the cage a few times, took out a pistol, and fired 3 shots into the drapery. Naturally, the pistol was supposed to fire blanks.
Obviously, that wasn't the case.
The pistol was loaded with real bullets. 2 of them caught me in the thigh. Did a lot of damage to muscle and tissue, but just barely missed an artery. I was lucky.
Lucky? How can you say that?
If I had not been partway out of the cage at the time, all 3 bullets would have gone straight into my chest.
Stunned, Irene stopped massaging his leg. I don't understand.
I was wrapped in a lot of chains. They looked impressive, but the whole assembly was designed to fall away when I unlocked a single lock. One of the assistants slipped the key to me just as I was lowered into the cage. I tried to use it as soon as the curtain was lowered around the cage, but it was the wrong key.
What did you do?
I'd never really felt comfortable relying on an assistant to slip me a key. I always carried a backup hidden in my hair. But it took me a few seconds to realize that the first key was the wrong one, and then a few more seconds to get the backup key and insert it into the lock. When the masked assistant fired the first 2 shots, I was only partway out of the cage. I normally would have been all the way out at that point.
So it wasn't an accident. The rumors were true. Someone tried to murder you.
It was all carefully planned, from the false key to the real bullets.
But who would want to kill you? Irene paused. That pair who eloped to Hawaii?
No. While I was recovering in the hospital, Chester conducted his own private investigation. It didn't take Sherlock Holmes to come up with a suspect. There was only one person who hated me enough to murder me on stage in front of a packed audience.
Of course, Irene said. Your friend and partner, Geddings.
That is very perceptive of you.
You became what he had always wanted to be, a brilliant magician who could thrill audiences, a star.
He had helped me become a skilled magician, but he was jealous of his own creation.
Geddings didn't create you, Oliver. Your talent is yours and yours alone. Geddings may have helped you perfect your skills, but he had to know that you would have become a success with or without him. That's why he was consumed with jealousy. No matter how skilled he was, he would never be the star that you became.
Well, he made sure that my stardom came to an end.
What happened to him?
Geddings? He died a few days later, shortly after the doctors concluded that I wasn't going to die or lose my leg.
How?
He put some more real bullets into the gun and shot himself in the head.
Suicide.
He left a wife and a son behind.
Do they know what he tried to do?
No. Oliver said. There was no reason to tell them. Chester and I let the accident story stand.
What about the other assistants? Did they figure it out?
I'm sure Willie did. Some of the others probably did too, but we don't talk about it.
A show business family secret.
Something like that, yes.
What happened to Geddings' wife and son?
Geddings didn't leave them much. He was never good with money.
Oliver set the empty glass aside.
I take care of his wife and son.
Irene smiled. Of course you do.
Chapter 51. The following evening, Julian was sharing a booth with Tremaine in the heavily shadowed hotel lounge when he heard the siren in the distance. It occurred to him that it was the first time he had been aware of a siren since his arrival in Burning Cove. One of the reasons, he reflected, was that the hotel was located nearly a mile outside of town. That lessened the odds of hearing emergency vehicles. It also increased the odds that the siren blaring in the night was headed toward the hotel. He paused his Manhattan halfway to his mouth and glanced toward the exit he had marked the first time he walked into the lounge. It was located at the end of a darkened hallway just past the men's room. Regardless of whether he was working or not, whenever he entered a confined space, he always made certain to identify at least one escape route that could be utilized in the event that things went wrong. His father had insisted that he establish the habit at the start of his career, and he had to admit that it had saved his neck on more than one occasion.
"Wonder what's going on,"
Nick said. His voice was slurred by the cocktails he had been drinking steadily since dinner. The wailing siren halted abruptly. Julian checked the bar. Willie was reaching for the phone. She spoke quietly into the receiver and then replaced it.
"Nothing to be concerned about," Willie announced calmly. "It's not a fire. There's been an accident in one of the villas. The ambulance has just arrived. Everything is under control."
But she looked troubled, Julian decided.
"Fuck," Nick muttered. "If it's another dead woman, I've been with you all evening, right?"
"Right," Julian said.
It was the truth. He kept his eye on Willie, who was doing her best to look cool and professional. He could tell she was concerned, though. She kept glancing out the window. There was nothing to be seen because the high hedges and the stucco walls that enclosed the hotel gardens blocked the view. A few curiosity seekers wandered outside with their drinks to find out what was going on. Willie disappeared briefly as well. When she returned, she was grim-faced. The siren started to scream again. Several of the people who had left a few minutes earlier returned. The rumors circulated swiftly through the crowd. Two men crowded up to the bar to order fresh drinks. Both were in their mid-30s. One was going bald. The other wore a badly tailored jacket. An attractive woman in a snug black dress and high heels slipped between the two men.
"What was all the excitement about?" the woman asked in a sultry voice.
The two men almost fell over themselves in an attempt to answer the question.
"Someone said the ambulance went to Oliver Ward's villa," Baldy announced, with authority, trying to impress the woman. "Heard he fell down the stairs."
"They found him unconscious," Bad Jacket explained. "Lot of blood."
Julian listened very closely.
"Ambulance attendants told someone Ward probably broke some bones, but it's the head injury they're worried about," Baldy added. "They're taking him to the hospital. They don't know if he'll make it."
"Hell of a thing," Bad Jacket shook his head. "He survives that warehouse fire only to fall down a flight of stairs."
"Wonder what he was doing going up and down stairs with that bad leg," Baldy mused.
Bad Jacket snickered.
"Five will get you 10. He went up those stairs to pay his house guest a late night visit. Heard she was the one who called the ambulance. Someone says she went to the hospital with him."
"Women," Baldy said. "They'll get you one way or another."
Willie dabbed at her eyes with a white towel. A moment later, she said something to the other bartender, a middle-aged man, and disappeared through a side door. Julian made his way to the bar.
"What can I get for you?" the bartender asked.
"Another Manhattan," Julian said, "and one for my friend. I heard there's been an accident."
"Yeah, just found out they took the boss to the hospital."
"Why did the other bartender leave?"
"Willie said she was going to drive to the hospital to see for herself just how bad things are. They don't know if he'll make it. If he doesn't, we'll all be looking for new jobs."
The bartender set two Manhattans on the bar. Julian carried them back to the booth. Nick grabbed his glass and took a long swallow. A short time later, Julian guided a very drunk Nick Tremaine to his villa. He did not bother to turn on the lights. He eased Tremaine down onto the bed. Tremaine muttered something unintelligible. Julian paused.
What?
Said, when are you going to take care of that damned reporter?
Soon. Good.
Julian let himself out into the night. Chapter 52. The only light inside the darkened villa came from the moon. It was all Julian needed to find his way down the hall. He had brought along a small flashlight to use once he began a serious search, but first he wanted to get an overview of the place. He had come in through the patio. The lock on the back door was good quality, but it was standard issue. You'd think a magician would have installed better locks. He did a quick walkthrough, noting the exit points. There were several, but they all opened onto the gardens that surrounded the villa. There were only two ways out of the gardens, the front gate and the one at the back. Upstairs in the guest bedroom, he discovered a narrow, decorative balcony. In a pinch, he could go over the railing and drop down into the gardens. Satisfied that he had noted all the exits, he took a good look around the guest bedroom. It was obvious from the clothes in the closet and the items arranged on the dressing table that it was the room Irene Glasson was using. He didn't expect to find the notebook conveniently stashed in a dresser drawer or under the mattress, but you never knew. People made odd decisions when it came to choosing a hiding place. Helen Spencer came to mind. She'd had a very fine safe, one he'd wasted several minutes cracking. But the only thing he found inside was the necklace. He'd considered helping himself to the jewelry. The gems were of excellent quality, but by then he knew enough about Spencer to be certain that the damned thing was hot. He didn't have any connections in the underground gemstone market. Locating a fence he could trust would have been a high-risk venture. The old man would not have approved. Besides, he didn't need the money. When he was satisfied that the notebook was not in the bedroom, he went downstairs to continue the search. On his initial foray, he had noticed the safe in the magician's study, but he had learned his lesson at Spencer's mansion. He saved the safe for last. Unlike the door locks, the one that secured the safe was modern and fairly sophisticated in design. He took that as a good sign. Something valuable was inside. He slipped the knife out of its sheath and set it on the floor within easy reach. Then he took out the stethoscope and went to work. When he heard the last muffled click, a thrill of anticipation swept through him. He took a deep breath and opened the door. There was a thick envelope inside. He removed the envelope, opened the unsealed flap, and switched on his flashlight. There was a leather-bound notebook inside. He took it out, flipped it open, and aimed the flashlight at a few of the pages. They were covered in numbers and equations. A euphoric triumph jolted through him. He had the notebook! Once it had been safely delivered to the old man, he could return to Burning Cove to take his time with Irene Glasson. She would pay for putting him to so much trouble. He closed the safe, picked up the knife, and got to his feet.
"I've been waiting for you, Enright."
Ward's voice came from somewhere out in the shadowed hallway. Julian froze. The realization that he had walked into a trap sent a shock of panic through him.
"Where are you, Ward? Show yourself, you bastard!"
There was no response. Now he had a choice to make. There were only two ways out of the study, the hallway and the glass doors that opened onto the patio. It seemed unlikely that Ward was working alone.
"Congratulations on your speedy recovery," Julian said. "The rumors in the bar had you at death's door."
Don't bother running, Ward said. All the exits from this villa are covered.
Julian listened intently. Ward's voice seemed to emanate from the living room. He had to assume Ward was armed. If he wasn't lying about the cops, they were no doubt covering all the other escape routes. That left his one last foolproof exit strategy. The old man wouldn't be thrilled that Julian had been forced to use it. There would be another boring lecture about his inclination toward impulsive action. But the present situation was a perfect example of why he carried the license in the first place. He went to the doorway of the study.
I'm coming out with my hands up, Ward. This is all a huge misunderstanding.
Let's clear up that misunderstanding, Ward said. Who hired you to kill Helen Spencer?
I didn't kill her. I'm a private detective from New York. I've got a license I can show you. I work for a company called Enright Investigations, family firm. We were hired to find the woman you know as Irene Glasson. She stole a certain notebook. Her real name is Anna Harris, by the way.
Who hired you?
Let's just say, our client represents a certain foreign government, one that is willing to pay very well for the notebook, no questions asked.
What about Saltwood Laboratory?
I see you've been doing some investigating of your own. Unfortunately, Saltwood made the mistake of going to the FBI for help. The investigation has ground to a standstill. The G-men are wringing their hands. The biggest fear, of course, is that Atherton's notes will wind up in the possession of an unfriendly foreign power.
Which is exactly what you intend, right?
Julian tried to curb his impatience, but he was getting nervous. It was time to end things.
Business is business, he said. The notebook will go to the highest bidder. Isn't that what you had planned? Your problem is that you don't have the connections it takes to find the deep-pocket customers for an item as exotic as Atherton's notes. You're just an innkeeper. Enright has a buyer lined up. In fact, it looks like there will be an auction. I suggest that you and I negotiate.
What makes you think I'm trying to figure out how to market the notebook?
I'm not a fool. You figured out the notebook is worth a fortune. You need Enright's help to sell it.
I'm interested.
Julian was almost giddy with relief. Now he was on firm ground. Suddenly everything made sense. He'd walked into a trap, all right, but not the kind he'd assumed at first. There were no cops waiting outside. Ward wouldn't be talking about a deal if that were the case. Julian allowed himself a small smile.
You have no idea what you're doing, you son of a bitch. You're just a washed-up magician who bungled his last performance so badly he nearly died. You're way out of your depth. I'll show you how the Enrights do business, he thought.
What price did you have in mind? He said.
I know the notebook is worth killing for, Ward said. That tells me it's worth a great deal to the people who hired you.
$100,000. Julian said, plucking a figure out of thin air.
Not good enough. I need to clear a quarter mil.
That's a lot of money, Julian said. Planning to buy another hotel?
He tried to sound reluctant, but it was all he could do to keep the rising tide of triumph out of his voice.
I owe Luther Pell $250, Ward said.
That explained a lot, Julian thought.
How did a smart guy like you get himself in so deep? He said. They say Pell's got mob connections.
You don't need to know the details. I doubt if your client will argue about the price. Not if the notebook is as important as you seem to think.
It is, trust me.
All right, make the deal. When I get the money, you'll get the notebook. Until then, it stays in my safe.
Ward didn't realize that his safe had been cracked. He assumed the notebook was still inside. Julian was dazed by his own good luck. A euphoric relief set fire to his blood.
All right, he said. He had to fight to keep his voice reasonably cool. I'll telephone my boss first thing in the morning. He'll have to set up the auction. It's going to take a little time to put the deal together. Maybe a couple of days. Fine. But meanwhile, you will continue to be a guest here at my hotel, where I can keep an eye on you. You don't leave the grounds.
Understood, Julian said. My security people will be watching you.
Sure.
Julian adjusted his right hand on the hilt of the knife, finding the position that allowed him the most control. Now that the bargain had been made, there was a very good possibility that the target would get careless. Talking about large sums of money had a tendency to do that to people, especially when you were having the discussion with a man who was in trouble with a shady character like Pell.
Come on, you bastard. All I need is one clear opportunity.
Are we finished here? He asked.
Looks like it. See you tomorrow.
Sure.
Just a dumb, failed magician, Julian thought. He made his way down the shadowed hallway. When he reached the living room, he held his breath. There was always the possibility that Ward had lied to him about wanting to make a deal. But that was unlikely. He wouldn't have set up the trap if he wasn't desperate to find a buyer for the notebook.
Julian crossed the living room, hurrying through the wedge of moonlight. It was the point at which he was most visible, and therefore most vulnerable. If Ward had deceived him, the shot would come during the second or two it took him to gain the shadows of the kitchen. There was no flash of light, no gun roared. He made it into the darkened front hall and paused to look back across the living room. A figure was clearly silhouetted against the glass doors that opened onto the patio. Ward's cane thudded softly on the tiles. Julian heard the rasp of shoe leather on the tiled floor.
Got you, Julian thought.
The throw was so fast and so clean that Ward never even got off a shot. The blade went home, sinking deep into human flesh. His target collapsed with a heavy, very final-sounding thud. The cane clattered on the floor. Julian did not waste any time making certain of the kill. He trusted his own skill and talent. If Ward wasn't dead already, he would bleed out as soon as someone removed the knife. He raced outside into the night. He had the notebook, but now there was a dead man, and that was a problem. Escape was his first priority. Ward's car was parked in front of the villa, the fastest car in California. He ran across the street and opened the car door. He could start a car without a key if necessary, but he wasn't worried about having to waste time doing so. It was not uncommon for people to leave the key in the ignition. That went double in crime-free small towns like Burning Cove. Besides, who would dare to steal Oliver Ward's car? Everyone in town probably recognized it on sight. But it was unlikely that anyone in L.A. would know it. He would be in the city by dawn. He was not disappointed. The key was in the ignition. His luck was holding. He got behind the wheel and started the vehicle. The big engine purred to life. He had 100 miles to drive on a foggy, twisty road, but he was a very skilled driver. The light mist would serve him well because it would keep other drivers from venturing out. Julian piloted the sleek vehicle quietly away from the villa, found Cliff Road, and settled down to drive. He'd been forced to leave some good clothes and a few personal items behind in his hotel room, but they could be easily replaced. He had to get the notebook to New York as soon as possible. He would catch a plane in L.A. Once Atherton's notes were safely in the old man's hands, he would return to California to take his time with Irene Glasson. Chapter 53. Julian had been driving for half an hour or so when the lights of another car sparked briefly in his rear view mirror.
Just another motorist braving the fog. No need to be alarmed.
He eased his foot down on the throttle and accelerated out of a tight curve. The lights vanished from his mirror. 5 minutes went by. 10. The lights from the other vehicle flashed again briefly in the mirror. Again, he accelerated. Again, the lights disappeared. He sped up, but almost immediately had to brake for a sharp curve in the road. The tires squealed in protest. There was no barrier at the edge of the pavement. If he miscalculated, he risked going off the high cliffs. He would plunge straight down onto the rocks at the water's edge. He came out of the next curve a little too fast, and immediately had to stomp on the brakes again. He glanced at the mirror. The lights were gone. There was no wailing siren. The other car didn't seem to be trying to overtake him. Not the cops, he told himself. Just another late-night driver trying to make it to L.A. by dawn. But the fog was growing thicker now. He could not risk driving any faster. The thrill of his escape from Burning Cove faded. He started to sweat, but he reminded himself that he was driving the fastest car in California. So much power under the hood, he could outrun any other vehicle on the road. Chapter 54.
Faster, Luther said. We can't risk losing him in this fog.
If he makes it to New York, Irene said, the police and the FBI won't be able to touch him.
We won't lose him, Oliver said.
The Oldsmobile belonged to Chester, who had done some work on it, but it wasn't nearly as fast as the modified Cord. Speed wasn't necessary, Oliver thought. The only thing that mattered was that they didn't lose the Cord. But that was unlikely. On a twisting ribbon of pavement like Cliff Road, what mattered most was the driver's skill and his knowledge of the curves. Oliver was behind the wheel because they had all agreed that he was the best driver. Luther was in the front passenger seat. In the dim glow of the instrument panel, he looked intense. Irene was in the back, draped over the front seat, peering through the windshield.
If he turns off on a side road, Luther began.
He won't, Oliver said. I know that bastard. He thinks he won.
The first part of the act had gone off without a hitch, which was somewhat amazing given the very short span of time they'd had to put it together, Oliver thought. There had been no practical way to rehearse. He and Luther had done several walkthroughs at the villa, trying to anticipate Enright's every move. Chester had pulled a couple of the old props out of the storage locker and reworked them. He had padded a figure with material that he claimed would sound a lot like human flesh when a knife or bullet struck it. Based on the description of Helen Spencer's murder, Oliver had been almost certain that the killer preferred to use a knife. Not only because it made less noise, but because he liked his work. But it hadn't really mattered which weapon Enright chose to use. Willie had been briefed on her role, and she had performed it brilliantly. Just like old times, Oliver thought. He had a sneaking hunch that Willie had enjoyed herself. Some of the guests had witnessed Irene following the stretcher into the back of the ambulance. She appeared to be sobbing hysterically. Persuading the ambulance crew to make a practice run to the villa that night was simple enough. Oliver had told the hospital authorities that he wanted to test the hotel's emergency response system. He had also offered a hefty donation to the hospital and paid the driver and attendants for their time. It had all been an elaborate show for an audience of one. But until the curtain rose, there had been no way to be certain that the killer would attend the performance. Oliver had tried to persuade Irene not to accompany Luther and him on the Cliff Road chase, but there was no talking her out of it.
"He's picking up speed again," Luther said. I think he spotted us.
He can't know it's us, Irene said. He thinks Oliver is dead or very badly hurt.
He's smart, Luther said. Maybe he's starting to realize he's been tricked.
If that's the case, he'll start taking even more chances, Oliver said. That would be good.
Luther glanced at him.
You did say he was the impulsive type.
Oliver accelerated gently. Up ahead, the lights of the stolen car appeared briefly in the fog, before vanishing around another curve. Chapter 55. Julian got only the smallest of warnings, a slight mushiness in the previously very crisp steering. He was driving Oliver Ward's car, a real engineering marvel. There couldn't be a problem with the steering. It wasn't possible. Ward had tricked him once tonight, but there was no way the magician could have known that he would take the custom-built car. No one would dare steal Oliver Ward's car. No one except me. He went into the next curve too fast. He stomped on the brakes and had to overcorrect with the steering. The tires shrieked. The brakes and the steering suddenly went to mush. He was going into a turn much too fast. He had no control. In the next horrifying instant, the fastest car in California was airborne, sailing over the high cliffs. He had just enough time to realize that this time he had underestimated the target, that there was no exit strategy. He screamed, just as so many of his targets had screamed. He wanted to beg for his life, but there was no one to hear him. His last conscious thought was that he could not be hurtling toward his own death. It was not possible. No target could fool him. He was Julian Enright. Chapter 56. Oliver accelerated out of a turn and realized that he could not see the lights of the cord. Luther said, "He may have found a side road."
"There aren't many near here," Oliver said.
"It's possible he's way ahead of us," Irene said. Black skid marks came up in the Oldsmobile's headlights.
"I don't think so," Oliver said.
He braked and brought the car to a halt on a narrow turnout. Opening the door, he grabbed his cane and a flashlight and climbed out. He stood for a few seconds listening. The only thing he could hear was the endless crash of the surf on the rocks below the cliff. He took his gun from the holster. Luther and Irene emerged from the car and followed him. Luther took out his gun and a flashlight. Irene held her small pistol in one hand.
"Stay back," Oliver said to her. "Please, if he's still alive, he'll be armed."
It didn't take long to find the cord. It was a crumpled mass of metal on the rocky beach below. The smell of gasoline was strong in the air. Julian Enright had been flung out of the vehicle. He had landed on the rocks a short distance from the wreckage. His neck was twisted at an odd angle. Luther looked at Oliver and said,
"You were right about him. Definitely the impulsive type."
"He was an easy read," Oliver said. "He was so damn sure he was smarter than everyone else. He was the master puppeteer who manipulated others. People like that never believe that they can be manipulated, too."
"What about the fake notebook?" Irene asked.
"He had it when he ran out of the villa," Oliver said. "It must be down there in the wreckage."
"I'll go down and take a look," Luther said.
Irene glanced at him. "Is that absolutely necessary?"
"We need to be sure," Oliver said. "I can't go down there, not with this damned leg."
"That leaves me," Luther said. "I'll get a rope."
He went to the car, opened the trunk, and took out a length of rope. He removed his jacket and pulled on a pair of driving gloves. Irene held the flashlight steady so that Oliver was free to handle the rope. Luther scrambled down to the wreckage. He checked the body first. He put his fingers on Enright's throat. He looked up and shook his head. Next, he went through Enright's clothes and removed a wallet. He flipped through it briefly and then stuck it back in the pocket of Enright's jacket. A short time later, he located the envelope that contained the fake notebook. He made his way back up the cliffs, took the notebook out of the envelope and handed it to Oliver.
"I'm amazed it survived," Oliver said.
Luther looked at him.
"We should get rid of it. We don't want people asking unnecessary questions."
Oliver looked down at the wreckage. The smell of gasoline was getting stronger.
"Got a match," he said.
"Thought you'd never ask."
Luther handed him a glossy black matchbook with the words Paradise Club printed in gold on the front. Oliver struck a match and touched it to one of the pages in the notebook. When he was sure the fire had taken hold, he tossed the burning notebook down onto the wreckage. The modified cord exploded into flames.
"Nothing better than fire to clean up a scene," Luther said.
Chapter 57. The four of them were gathered in the living room of Casa del Mar. Oliver was in his big chair. Luther was pouring himself a whiskey. Chester was mourning the loss of his magnificent creation. Irene paced the room, restless and unnerved, still shaky with relief. After 4 long months, it was difficult to believe that the personal nightmare that had chased her to California was finished.
"I called the police station," Oliver said. He stretched out his bad leg. "I explained that someone broke into my place, cracked the safe, and stole my car while I was busy with the emergency drill. When they find the wreckage and recover the body, I'll identify Enright as a guest here at the hotel. I'll suggest that he must have gotten drunk and decided to pull a stunt."
"It will be interesting to see who shows up to claim the body," Irene said.
"Yes," Oliver said. "Most wealthy families would commission a funeral director to take possession of the body and accompany it back east."
"A distraught, grieving parent might feel compelled to make the trip out west himself," Irene said, "especially if he's hoping to find a certain notebook."
"If someone from the Enright family does show up, we'll make sure that he or she is given the charred remains of the notebook. The pages will have been destroyed, but some remnants of the cover will probably survive. Leather doesn't burn easily."
Irene looked at him. "Do you think it might be recognized as a fake?"
It was Chester who responded.
"Nah! I did a damned good job with those calculations, if I do say so myself. It would take an expert to figure out that they're gibberish, and he'd need most of the notebook to verify that, not just the burnt leather cover and some charred pages."
Oliver sank deeper into the reading chair and rotated a glass of whiskey slowly between his palms.
"The illusion is good. It will fool the audience if necessary."
Chester peered at him.
"You've still got the real notebook. What are you going to do about it?"
"I'm working on that," Oliver said. "One more thing. Willie and the others know that they helped capture a suspected hotel thief. They're aware that the thief took off in my car. In the morning, when the police find the accident site, everyone will know the burglar drove the cord off a cliff. Everyone will assume he lost control."
Chester shrugged.
"That was exactly what happened."
Luther lounged against the wall, whiskey glass in hand.
"Obviously. Everyone knows that car was unique. That's why you never let anyone else drive it. Too dangerous." "Just another drunk driving accident," Chester said.
"One that took care of a professional killer," Oliver said.
"We had to be sure," Luther added. "We couldn't let him escape. He would have come back."
Irene looked at the others. They had taken a terrible risk, and now they were forever bound by a dark secret. The fact that Oliver and Chester had made some last-minute modifications to the brakes and steering on the fastest car in California would never go beyond the four of them.
"More whiskey, anyone?"
Luther asked. Chapter 58. He felt her leave the bed. He opened his eyes and watched her pull on a robe and pad quietly out the door. She vanished into the shadowed hallway. He shoved aside the covers, got up, shrugged into a robe and followed her. She was in the living room, gazing out over the garden and the pool to the ocean beyond. The first light of dawn was brightening the sky. He moved to stand behind her and rested his hands lightly on her shoulders. Her tension was palpable. Gently he began to massage the taut muscles. "Didn't mean to wake you," she said.
You're thinking about Peggy Hackett, aren't you? He asked.
Now that Enright is dead, I can't stop thinking about Peggy Hackett, Gloria Maitland, Daisy Jennings, and that other woman, Betty Scott, who died in Seattle nearly a year ago. I know I'm missing some crucial detail, but I have no idea what it could be.
Some detail that will prove Tremaine murdered all of them.
Yes. It's horrifying to know that I'll have to wait until another woman dies before I'll have a chance to find a fresh angle or a new source.
I understand.
She reached up to grip one of his hands. I know you do. They stood quietly for a time. Sooner or later, another woman will die, she said after a while.
You're sure of that?
There's a pattern.
One of the things I learned as a magician is that the mind can play tricks when it comes to seeing patterns. If we want to see them, we can usually find a way to do it. It's human nature. There are a lot of illusions and effects that rely exclusively on that fact.
She turned to face him. 4 women are dead. They're all connected to Nick Tremaine in one way or another. That's not an illusion, that's a pattern.
You've been a little distracted lately.
That's for sure.
Maybe it's time to go back to the beginning and try to view everything in your notes with clear eyes, he said. Stop looking for the pattern you think you see.
What should I look for?
A new pattern.
She thought about that. Maybe you're right. It's not like I've got a better idea. I keep circling back to the question I've had from the beginning. Maybe starting over will give me a fresh perspective.
What's the question?
Nick Tremaine's name has been linked to several women in the 2 years he's been in Hollywood, but only 4 of them have died under mysterious circumstances. My question is, what did they know that got them killed?
Good question.
He put his arms around her. He wrapped her close and held her very tight. Chapter 59. They ate breakfast on the patio. Fresh melon, scrambled eggs, toast, and a large pot of coffee, all delivered as if by magic. I could get used to room service, Irene said.
It has its advantages, Oliver said.
So now we wait until the police confirm Enright's identity and notify his family, Irene said. What if it turns out he was a fraud?
It's possible that the man who went over the cliff in my car stole Julian Enright's identity, but I doubt it, Oliver said. It would have been too risky, for one thing. There was always the chance that he would have run into someone from the Enright social circle on vacation out here in California. But that aside, I'm sure the bastard was who he claimed to be.
Because of his arrogance.
He was a man born to wealth and privilege, who thought he could get away with murder.
And espionage. He was willing to sell vital national secrets to some foreign interests. That makes him a traitor as well as a killer.
Yes, it does.
Oliver finished his coffee, kissed her lightly on the mouth, and levered himself to his feet. Just like a comfortably married couple, Irene thought, except that they weren't married. Details.
I've got to take care of some business in the office, Oliver said. Security is keeping a close eye on Tremaine around the clock. In addition, I'll make sure one of the guards is stationed outside of this villa. Promise me you won't leave this place alone.
I promise, she said. She waited until he left, and then she went back inside the villa to collect her notes. She took them outside onto the patio, determined to start at the very beginning. She would begin the way Peggy Hackett had taught her, by setting down every hard fact she had in her possession, regardless of how ephemeral it seemed. She would follow every loose end. She would ask the question that she had been asking from the very beginning. Why the 4 women had died? They had each known something, she thought, or discovered something that threatened Nick Tremaine. It was the only explanation that made any sense. An hour later, she sat back and looked at her notes, searching for some pattern that she had not noticed previously. Nothing. The only thing that stood out was the fact that all the victims, except the first one, had lived in Los Angeles. She returned to the short cryptic note that she had found when she cleaned out Peggy's desk. It included the name Betty Scott, the woman found dead in a bathtub in Seattle. And there was a phone number. Peggy's advice whispered through her. When you're stuck, go back over every detail. Find one more detail, because there is always one more detail. She rose, went into the living room, and picked up the phone.
Operator, I'd like to call a Seattle newspaper. No, I don't care which one. Yes, the Post-Intelligencer sounds fine.
The phone was answered by a receptionist who sounded rushed.
How may I direct your call?
I'm a reporter in Burning Cove, California. I'd like to speak with one of your crime reporters.
Hold on one moment, I'll connect you.
A short time later, Irene found herself talking to a bored-sounding individual who identified himself as George.
You want me to dig out a year-old obituary notice? Why should I do you any favors?
Because I'm working on an investigation that involves Nick Tremaine.
The actor?
The boredom was replaced by a flicker of interest.
What have you got?
I'm chasing leads at this point, but if you give me a hand, I promise to call you as soon as I've got a story you can run with.
Nick Tremaine, huh? All right. Give me time to go down to the morgue and pull some clips.
He paused.
I'll have to reverse the charges.
That's fine. George called back 15 minutes later.
I found Scott's obit, but there's not much info here, he said. I don't see how this is going to help. Scott slipped and fell in her bathtub, worked at a cafe, survived by an aunt who lives here in Seattle.
There is always one more detail.
I need the name of the aunt.
Dorothy Hodges. Look, what have you got on Tremaine?
I have to move quickly here. I give you my word, I'll contact you as soon as I've got all the facts.
Irene hung up and made the next call.
Operator, please connect me with Dorothy Hodges in Seattle, Washington. No, I don't have the number or the address. Yes, I'll hold.
It turned out that there were three D. Hodgeses in the Seattle telephone directory. The operator connected Irene to the right one on the second attempt. A middle-aged woman answered.
This is Dorothy Hodges. Whom did you say is calling? You don't know me, Miss Hodges. I'm a journalist doing some background research on a movie actor named Nick Tremaine. Heavens, dear, you must have the wrong number. I don't know Nick Tremaine. I don't know any movie stars. This is Seattle, not Hollywood. I have reason to believe that Tremaine may have known your niece, Betty. Betty? She passed almost a year ago. Yes, I know, Miss Hodges. Did you ever meet any of Betty's boyfriends? No. I know that for a time she dated a young man who wanted to become an actor. Betty fancied herself in love with him, but she never brought him around to introduce him. I don't remember his name. I understand Betty lived in a boarding house. She was a bit wild, I'm afraid. Ran with a fast crowd. I had to insist that she move out. I just couldn't tolerate the smoking and the drinking and the partying. She visited me once in a while when she needed rent money. All she ever talked about was her dream of going to Hollywood with her boyfriend. She was sure they would both become stars. Poor, foolish girl. Did she ever do any real acting? Oh, yes. She made a couple of films here in Seattle. She was very excited about them, but they never got released. What happened? The studio burned down a few months before Betty died. She told me that all the films, including the ones she made, were destroyed. Between you and me, I did wonder exactly what sort of movies they were, if you take my meaning.
The kind of movies that could ruin a rising star's career, maybe, Irene thought.
I understand, Miss Hodges. You said you never met any of Betty's boyfriends. What about her girlfriends? Did you know any of them? I'd really like to talk to someone who knew Betty well. Why are you so curious about my poor niece? It's a long story, Miss Hodges, but I think it's possible that Betty's death wasn't an accident. I think she was murdered.
Murdered? Shock reverberated through the telephone line.
But that can't be true. They said that Betty slipped and fell in the bathtub.
I know, Miss Hodges, but as it happens, she's not the only woman to die that way. I'm hoping that if I track down someone who knew about those films that Betty made, I might be able to get the truth.
I see. Well, I'm afraid the only girlfriend that Betty ever mentioned was another aspiring actress. She lived at the same boarding house, as I recall. She was in those films that Betty made here in Seattle.
One more detail, Irene thought. Do you remember the name of the other actress? She asked, hardly daring to hope.
No, but I'm sure the woman who ran the boarding house can tell you. As Betty said, Betty and her friend both had rooms there. Those two had a falling out at some point, I do remember that much.
You mean their friendship ended?
Oh, yes. Betty didn't talk about it much, at least not to me, but she was real cut up about it.
What broke up the friendship?
What do you think? A man, of course. Betty said that her actor boyfriend ran off to Hollywood with the other girl.
Do you remember what sort of work Betty's girlfriend did? Aspiring actresses usually have to support themselves while they wait to be discovered.
Yes, I know. Betty was a waitress.
What about her girlfriend?
I seem to recall that she worked in an office, but I can't remember any details. Like I said, she ran off with that actor fellow quite a while before Betty died.
Thank you. You've been very helpful, Miss Hodges.
You're welcome, dear. You will let me know if you find out for certain that my niece was murdered, won't you?
Yes, I will. Poor Betty. Stars in her eyes, that girl. Irene was about to hang up, but she glanced at her notes and realized she hadn't asked all of her questions. One more thing, Miss Hodges.
Yes?
Do you remember the name of the restaurant where Betty worked?
Oh, yes. The First Avenue Cafe. The owner is a very nice man. He was the only one who bothered to send me a note after Betty died. I drop in for a coffee once in a while.
Thank you, Miss Hodges. Irene made a note and hung up. Don't rush, she told herself. Take it step by step the way Peggy taught you. She picked up the phone again.
Operator, please connect me with Mrs. Phyllis Kemp in Seattle, Washington, she said.
Yes, I have the number.
Kemp answered on the third ring. She sounded annoyed.
Kemp Apartments, she said. If you're calling about the room that was advertised in the paper, you're too late. It's already been rented.
This isn't about the room, Mrs. Kemp. This is Irene Glasson. We spoke over a week ago. I asked you about one of your boarders, Betty Scott.
Yes, I remember.
Kemp's tone switched from annoyed to suspicious.
Why are you calling again? I told you it was an accident. She slipped and fell in the bathtub.
I'm following up on a lead, Mrs. Kemp. I've just spoken with Betty Scott's aunt, who told me that Betty had a friend there at your boarding house, another aspiring actress who worked in an office. I'm trying to find her.
Sorry, I can't help you. She moved out before Betty died.
What was her name?
I don't recall offhand. I'd have to look it up in my files. I don't have time to do that.
Miss Hodges seems to think that the other woman ran off with Betty's boyfriend.
I wouldn't know about that. I make it a policy to never get involved in my boarders' private lives. I'm going to hang up now. I've got better things to do than to talk to a reporter.
The line went dead. Irene sat quietly, thinking about what she had learned. Oliver had said that Nick Tremaine's accent sounded more West Coast than Midwest. It wasn't too much of a stretch to imagine that he hailed from Seattle instead of Chicago, and that possibly he had made a couple of pornographic films before leaving town to start a career in Hollywood. Studio fixers like Ernie Ogden cleaned up that sort of problem on a regular basis. But what if Nick Tremaine had decided to return to Seattle to erase his own past? She picked up the phone again and asked the operator to connect her with the First Avenue Cafe in Seattle. The proprietor answered on the fourth ring. He sounded busy and impatient, but when she told him why she was calling, his mood changed.
"I sure do remember Betty Scott and her actor friends," he said. He chuckled. "They used to come in here and talk me into giving them free coffee. I felt sorry for them, you know. They all had dreams of going to Hollywood. One of them actually made it.
Which one?
Archie Guthrie, good-looking young man. He had that certain quality. Always figured that if any of them made it, he would be the one, and sure.